Listen to the voices of the advocates. Hello, listener. Our guest this week is the Right Honourable the Baroness Hill of Richmond. Brenda Hill is a distinguished legal mind, known for her remarkable contributions to the British legal system and her unwavering commitment to equality and human rights. Described as a woman of many firsts, in 2004, she joined the House of Lords as a Lord of Appeal in the Ordinary. She is the only woman to have been appointed to that position. In 2017, Baroness Hill was appointed under the premiership of Theresa May to serve as the President of the Supreme Court, becoming the first woman to serve the role. Beyond her achievements, Brenda Hill has been a tireless advocate for equality and the rights of marginalized groups. Her landmark judgments have shaped legal principles on important issues such as gender equality and social justice. Gopal and I had the distinct pleasure of speaking to her on this edition of Advocates, the podcast. We hope you enjoyed the episode.
Can I begin by saying, Baroness Hill, thank you very much for being on our podcast.
It's a great pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. Now, Baroness, we usually start these podcasts by asking about our guests' background, where they grew up, how they grew up, and about their parents and siblings. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I grew up in a small village in the north of England, a very rural community. My father was headmaster of a small independent boys' boarding school. My mother ran the boarding house. I had two sisters, one who was a lot older than me, so she didn't really count, and one who was only just over a year younger than me. And our mother dressed us alike, and so most people thought we were twins. But so it was three daughters, very education-orientated background. I think both of our parents believed in getting ahead through education. It was taken for granted that all three of us would go to university if we could. And I'm talking about the 1950s and 1960s here, when only about 2.5% of girls of the relevant age group went to university. So you can see that was quite an ambition to have.
Yes. So what happened to your sisters? Did they both make it to university as well?
Oh, yes. They both actually went to the University of Nottingham.
Right.
My elder sister read Spanish and my younger sister read English. And so, yes, they both fulfilled the parents' ambitions.
Right. But, yeah, but you're the only lawyer in the family.
I'm the only lawyer in the family, yes.
Okay. Now, growing up in this rural community and with your parents so keen on education, did you feel any sort of pressures in school to do well?
Well, I certainly wanted to do well. Whether that was the result of pressure or whether it was internal or a bit of both, I don't know. I was the youngest girl in my class because I went up to the high school in the local town of Richmond. That's the original Richmond, after which all the other Richmonds in the world are directly or indirectly
right?
named. Yes, oh. It is.
Okay.
Yes, it's an ancient town with a medieval castle and so on and so forth. But anyway, when I went to that school, I was the youngest girl in the school. So I wasn't expecting to do particularly well. And then I found that I did do well. And in most subjects, I was top of the class. And so, of course, once you start being top of the class, you want to go on being top of the class, don't you?
Well, I was never there, so I can't speak to that.
Well, it was a very small school, a very small class. So, you know, I was always afraid that, yes, I was a big fish, intellectually at least, in a very small pond. So once I went to a bigger pond, like Cambridge, I was not expecting to do well. I was expecting to be a very small fish in that big pond. And then it turned out that I did do well.
Let me just go back a little bit to your time in secondary school in Richmond. I read that your main interest at that time was in history. So how did you switch from there to thinking about doing law?
Well, yes, my best subject, or at least my favourite subject at school, was indeed history. But I had always taken quite an interest in the British Constitution and the history of the British Constitution. In fact, I did suggest to my headmistress that I did it for A-level, but she wasn't keen on that because they weren't going to be able to teach me. And No, she wanted me to do well, so she wanted me to take subjects that they could teach me. So I carried on with history, Latin and French, very good combination for reading law. But my head teacher was a historian. And I tend to say that the reason that I went into law was that she didn't think I was clever enough to read history. That's not quite true. Basically, what she said to me was, Brenda, I want you to try for Oxford and Cambridge. You could try for both in those days. But I don't think you're a natural historian. She was. I mean, she was an Oxford history graduate. So what else might you put in for? And she was rather keen on economics. I wasn't keen on economics because I'm not a theoretician and there's an awful lot of theory in economics. So I said, well, what about law? Because of this interest in the Constitution. And really, to her credit, because this was a very small school in a backwater, you know, she didn't say, nonsense, girls don't do law, which was by and large true in those days, or you only do law if your father's a lawyer, which again was by and large true. She didn't say that. She said, that's a good idea, and let's go for it. So we did. And it turned out that we were both right.
And was that the only subject that you applied for at university?
Yes.
Okay. And then at Cambridge, you mentioned in your biography, and I thought very interestingly, a comment from Lord Hoffman, who said, if you want to know how a judge thinks, find out who taught them at university.
This is true. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So tell us who your inspiration.
Well, there was a wonderful teacher at Cambridge when I was there who'd only quite recently arrived, the chap called Tony Weir. He wrote a textbook later on about tort, but he was basically a common law obligations lawyer. But he had a wonderful gift for putting things in a new light, bringing things to life. He cared about his students a lot, but he was a great teacher as well. So he was definitely one of the inspirations and a very kind person. I'm told that he was actually quite a misogynist. And that wouldn't surprise me, but he was always very kind to me. So perhaps he made an exception in my case.
Just sort of segueing from that, Cambridge, at the time you were there as a woman reading, you know, as you've put it, a very sort of masculine degree, what was that like?
Oh, it was great. Good fun. That's when it turned out that I'd been right to choose law, because I turned out to be quite good at it. Well, then I could relax and enjoy myself, you know, worked hard and got on with being the best I could be at the subject I was studying, but also having a great deal of fun. And there were, in my day, there were 3 women's colleges and 21 men's colleges. So the undergraduate sex ratio was basically 9 men to every 1 woman. Now, this can be daunting, but it can also have its benefits and advantages. And I think it meant that those among the women who wanted to have fun as well as study were able to have fun. And so that's what I did. So, no, it wasn't daunting at all. It really wasn't daunting.
Really? Okay. Let me ask you about your interest in sort of family law and children and law regarding them. Clearly, later in your career, it played a very central part. But where did that interest start? Was it Cambridge?
Well, I did. One of the optional subjects which I chose to do was family law for my TRIPORS. Interestingly, the very sweet, charming bachelor who taught us family law, he had a seminar group, a small group of women, and he told us we should forget our family law after we had done our exams because it wouldn't do us any good to know our rights. He obviously thought we were all going to become wives and mothers and it was better off if we didn't. Well, actually, in the 1960s, wives and mothers had really very few rights. They were not well looked after by family law. And so it was an astonishing thing, in a way, for him to have said. So, yes, I was interested in it, but I was also interested in everything else. So when I went to Manchester to teach law, I think I taught 7 subjects, but so lots and lots of things. And the lecture course that I did first was in constitutional and administrative law. And I only took over the family law lectures after 7 years. So it was a gradually increasing interest.
Right.
As I began to do research, write books and so on and so forth, I think it developed. Part of it also was that when I first went to Manchester to teach in the late 1960s, it was a very exciting time for family law. A lot was going on. A lot of the things that were wrong with it were being put right or righter. And but the major textbook was written by a man. And I actually thought, I wasn't alone in this, that it was about time some women got interested in the subject, because this might just possibly even up the approach to it's a very gendered subject, family law, and people come at it from very different perspectives. So that's how I got into it.
Right. Sort of, if we go back a little bit to Lady Hale at Cambridge, finishing your degree, obviously in law, there are very many paths. You've got practice and academia. So I've got two questions. Firstly, why academia, not practice at that time? And second, how did you end up in Manchester?
Well, I think the why academia was that I didn't fancy going immediately to do another lot of exams. I had actually been offered articles by one of the major London, City of London firms, but that would have involved going and doing an intensive 6-month course and another set of exams. And I felt, look, I've been working so hard for my Cambridge exams, I think, you know. And my director of studies said, well, you know, you could walk into an academic job if you wanted to. So I thought, oh, well, I'll go and see what academic jobs there are. And there were jobs available being advertised in Manchester and in Bristol. And they both offered me a junior teaching post. Now, most people in that situation, I don't know how well you know those two cities, but I think most people would choose Bristol as being, on the whole, the more beautiful place. And in some ways, no, not the more exciting. I chose Manchester because they wanted me to qualify as a barrister and practice as a barrister alongside my teaching.
Oh, I see.
So that's why I chose Manchester, so that I could have the best of both worlds. And then right. I'd be able to choose, right, after a few years, whether I wanted to stay in academia or whether I wanted to concentrate full-time on practice.
So that was something they actually encouraged you to do, that sort of parallel path.
They did. You can't really do it anymore, because in order to get an academic post, you've normally got to get a research degree. And of course, in order to practice, you've got to qualify. And I was able to qualify as a barrister in I was called to the bar in 1969, but I actually passed the bar final exam in 1967. And I was able to do that by buying a self-tuition correspondence course and studying in the long vacation after my first year of teaching for about 8 weeks on this self-tuition correspondence course. And that enabled me to pass the exam with flying colours. So it was a lot easier in those days to qualify as a barrister than it now is.
And of course, those 8 weeks that you did, you ended up topping the bar exams, am I right?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Just so we get that clear.
Yes. But that just shows how easy the exams were, doesn't it? Yeah.
Well, I don't know. Clearly for you, Lady Hale, but
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think both Gopal and I did the old style barrister's exams, because we both qualified in the early 90s. Could I just say, there's nothing easy about those exams, Lady Hale. So the fact that you did it in 8 weeks correspondence course says something about you rather than about the rest of us here who really struggled to pass the bar, quite frankly.
You are a lot younger than I am, and I think that by the time you were taking those exams, they would have become more difficult, because definitely the bar was a bit embarrassed that it was so easy to qualify as a barrister compared with qualifying as a solicitor, and so they started to make it more difficult.
Right. So this system that you had where you could teach and practice, and that's quite American, I think. A lot of American sort of professors, I think, do that. How did you balance that, being a part-time barrister and the teaching?
Well, it was hard work, because obviously the research and writing that academics have to do had to take second place to the cases that I had to do. And I was a sort of jobbing junior common law barrister, which meant that I did a bit of crime, I did a bit of civil, I did a bit of family, and it was going around the local courts, or lots of courts in the Manchester area. But you could be, you could find yourself at 6 o'clock in the evening with a brief to go to one of the Lancashire towns to do a case the following day. I'm sure you know the sort of situation. And there was an excitement about it. It was great in many ways, but it did mean I couldn't. The teaching meant that I couldn't take the longer cases because I had fixed times for my teaching, and the advocacy meant that I couldn't do the research and writing, which is why it's not, in the ordinary common law world, it's not sustainable for a long period. If you're in some specialist area where you're not in court all the time, and well, or if you're an international lawyer, for example, or if you're in one of the more prestigious areas, maybe it's possible to sustain it for much longer. But as a general jobbing barrister on the Northern Circuit, it wasn't sustainable for too long.
Did you enjoy the practice, going to courts, the last minute reading of briefs, the preparing of the witnesses, the cross-examination and all that?
Yes. Yes, I did enjoy it very much indeed. But I also enjoyed the teaching. And the thinking and so on. So I enjoyed them both. And eventually, when I had to choose, I did choose to concentrate on academia rather than to stay at the bar. And there were several reasons for that. The principal one was that my husband was also starting out at the Manchester Bar, and he was very determined that that's what he wanted to do. And I think we thought it was not a bad idea if one of us had a salary. Because, as you know, starting out at the bar, it can take a very long time to get established. But even if you're established, it can take a very long time to get paid. And the one good thing about university teachers is, although they're not necessarily paid very much, they are paid. And there were things like pensions, sick leave, and maternity leave. So that was one reason. Another reason was that we wanted a family, and it's much easier to combine academic life with a family than practice at the bar. There are brilliant women who have managed to combine practice at the bar, but it needs an awful lot to be in your favour. You know, you need to have a successful enough practice that you can afford all the help that you need to succeed. And that help is very expensive in England. It may not be quite as expensive in Malaysia, but in England it's very expensive. So you have to be in a field of practice where you can afford it. You have to have good facilities, childcare facilities, schools and the like. And you have to have a supportive partner, I think. That's almost certainly the main feature. I'm not saying that my husband would not have been supportive. He would have been supportive. But on the whole, we thought that the choice that I made was the more practical one. And I don't regret it at all.
Let me take you back a little to your first years at the Manchester Bar. So 69, you're called. What was it like practicing as a woman in Manchester?
That's a very good question. Almost every set of chambers in Manchester, and there were quite a few. I mean, the Manchester Bar was quite large. They almost all had at least one woman by the time I joined. So I was not the first woman. I was the second woman in the chambers that I joined. And I quite often say, people say I've been the first woman this and the first woman that, but I have also been the second woman quite a few times. And I was the second woman in the chambers that I joined. So I'm eternally grateful to the first woman who didn't pull up the drawbridge, didn't frighten the horses and so on, and was very friendly and welcoming. And I definitely thought, well, if she can do it, I can try and do it too. So it wasn't too bad. And we had always in front of us in the north of England the example of Rose Heilbronn. Now, Rose Heilbronn was one of the first, there were two women who became, as it was, King's Counsel in 1949, the first women King's Counsel. She had an incredibly successful practice. as a common law practitioner, criminal and civil. She was very famous. You know, these were in the days when newspapers reported murder trials virtually verbatim. And she was very often in the newspapers because she did defend a lot of murderers. But she did a lot of other stuff as well. So we had this great star as a role model for us in the North. She was in many ways badly treated, but nevertheless, she was a great success and a great star. And there were also a couple of women at the Manchester Bar who were sort of maybe 10 years senior to me, who were also very successful. So there were role models, even though we were a small minority. There were people that you could aspire to be like, which is good.
Right. But did you ever face situations where a solicitor would decline to instruct you because you were a woman in those days?
Oh, probably.
Yeah.
Probably. But of course, we didn't know that because in the early days, what happens is that a brief comes into chambers, either because the solicitors send briefs into chambers, you know, without anybody's name on it. And the clerk would say, well, I've got Mrs. X and I've got Mr. Y, etc. And our clerk did, I think, try pretty hard to sell me. But I'm sure there will have been occasions when the solicitors would have said, oh, no, we're not having her. You know, but then you can try and sometimes they have to have you because that's all there is available. And then they can learn that, yes, maybe you can do it after all.
Yeah. Right. So learning advocacy at the bar when you first started, who stood out as a teacher for you? And what were the main lessons that you took as an advocate at that in those early years?
Well, I can share a story with you which says something about attitudes to women at the Manchester Bar. My pupil master was a very senior junior because silks weren't allowed to take pupils, so they had to be juniors. But he was a very senior one, and in fact, he became a judge just at the end of my pupilage. And I'd been told that he didn't approve of women at the bar.
Mm-hmm.
So halfway through my pupilage, because we got on very well, halfway through my pupilage, I said, well, rumour has it that you don't approve of women at the bar. And he said, rumour is correct. So I said, well, why is that? Your wife's a doctor, you know, a practising doctor. And he said, oh, that's because medicine is a caring profession and women both can and should care. But the bar is a fighting profession, he said. And women shouldn't or can't fight. And he said that in his experience, I think he was wrong about this, women were either too obstinate or too yielding. And I thought that was very instructive because he's right. The bar is a fighting profession, but it's also a profession in which you've got to have the judgment to know what to fight, and when to get out of the case as best you can, you know, at the best possible settlement and so on. So you've got to be prepared to settle, but you've also got to be prepared to fight. I thought those were very wise words. So he was right about the bar, but of course he was totally wrong about women.
Women. Okay. What was the most important lesson, Lady Hill, that you took from the bar to the bench?
That's a very good question, and difficult for me to answer, because I had been away from the bar for many years before I went on the bench. But I think that I will have taken the lesson, perhaps, of how not to behave as a judge. You know, from my experience, you know, as a jobbing common law barrister, junior end of the bar, experiencing, we did in those days have some judges whose conduct on the bench left something to be desired. That, you know, impatient, not listening, making up their minds before they'd heard the evidence or the argument, being rude is possibly putting it too strongly, but certainly not totally courteous to either the advocates appearing in front of them or to the witnesses and so on. And so I think I learnt from my time at the bar how not to behave as a judge.
Right, right. I hope some judges can pick that up as well. Can I ask you about taking silk? You took silk in 89. And how did that come about, given that you decided that academia was going to be your path?
Well, those were the days when both any judicial appointment or most judicial appointments and silk depended on a tap on the shoulder from the Lord Chancellor's officials. And in 1982, I think, I got a tap on the shoulder to become a part-time judge, what was then called an assistant recorder. So in the Crown Court doing jury trials and in the County Court doing civil work. So I had been a part-time judge for some years before I got another phone call from maybe the same official, but certainly the same department, saying, had I ever thought of taking silk? Well, I said, no, I haven't thought of taking silk because I'm not in practice. And he said, ah, yes, but we have something, we have a category called employed barristers who can take silk. They abandoned that for a while. I think they've now reinstated it because they understand that employed barristers are an important branch of the profession. So he suggested that I applied for silk as an employed barrister. And surprise, surprise, I was given it. And it was all part of a longer term plan that if I turned out all right, they might suggest that I became a High Court judge.
Right, right.
It was sort of a path. Yes, it wasn't. Yeah. It obviously wasn't a necessary destiny, but it was definitely sort of putting the building blocks in place for that to happen if they thought it a good idea.
So how long did you continue after 69 as a part-time barrister as well as a academic?
Oh, I think I gave up the bar in 72. Okay. So I wasn't there. It's only about 3 years.
Three years.
I was just wondering because you were an academic for a long time. You wrote books, you rose up in your department, and then you became a deputy High Court judge. I mean, deputy Crown Court judge, a judge actually. And then you're listening to all these cases. Did that necessitate a change in mindset? How do you approach these matters, jury trials and all that?
Well, that's again an interesting question. The part of judging that I was least comfortable with was jury trials. The civil and family, where you are the decision maker, and you listen to the evidence, make up your mind who's telling the truth or who's closest to the truth, which is more usually the case. You know what the law is, you listen to the arguments, and you then reach a judgment, which is a reasoned judgment. So it's not unlike an academic exercise. You know, when you look at the evidence, you look at the arguments, and you reason towards a viable conclusion. A logical or at least a possible conclusion. So I didn't find civil and family judging that different. But criminal trials, jury trials, where, especially in those days, the rules of evidence were so often counterintuitive. There were things that one had to exclude from the jury's consideration because it was thought to be more prejudicial than probative, et cetera, stuff about character. Things that they had said, interviews with the police, quite a lot of them had to be redacted in order to get rid of stuff that wasn't admissible. And so one was always afraid that you would get something that little bit wrong and a perfectly good trial would be overturned on appeal. So I didn't find presiding over jury trials the most comfortable experience, but of course I did it.
You spoke earlier about the book Woman and the Law that you wrote in 1984, and frankly, I can't understand how you were able to do that and teach and all the other things you're doing at that time. But can I now pivot to your time as a law commissioner? And you came in and I think you worked on the Family Law Act and Mental Capacity Act and, you know, pieces of social legislation. And what was the background to that? Why were you picked in order to look at these bits of legislation?
Well, I don't think I was picked in order to look at those bits of legislation. I think I was picked because the Law Commission had a programme of reform in family law ever since it began. It was set up in 1965, and it had done a lot of work in family law, but there was still work to be done. And so when they actually advertised for law commissioners in 1984, they wanted a family lawyer. And so I joined the Law Commission in order to head the family law team. But the first project that we spent a lot of time on was the law relating to children, because the law relating to children, the upbringing of children, was in a complete mess. Many different statutes, many different courts, all with different law applicable in different courts. Ridiculous. Right? The law should be the same, whichever court you're in. And I couldn't go on. There are so many things wrong with it. So that's what we spent most of our time on to begin with, the law relating to children. But lurking in the background, there was divorce law, there was domestic violence and abuse, and there was eventually mental capacity. And so we took those on, the ground for divorce. We produced a report on that. Now, here is a story about law reform. We produced a report proposing a very simple way of getting divorced. Basically, you said on day one, I believe that our marriage is irretrievably broken down. And then you said on day 365, our marriage has irretrievably broken down and you got your divorce. So no messing about, no having to show what had happened and who might be to blame or anything like that. And the Family Law Act did enact something along those lines. But along the way, government and parliament had added so many bits and pieces to our simple scheme that it was completely unworkable. So although it got passed, it never got put into force, and indeed it was subsequently repealed. However, very recently, a scheme which was almost identical, except that instead of a year waiting period, 6 months waiting period, has become our law. So never say never in law reform.
So how many years is that between your proposal and
20 years later? Well, it's 30 years later.
Oh, just 30. Right. Okay.
The Law Commission scheme has found its day. So right. That was
30 years, a blink of an eye in terms of the law.
Well, that is true. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Now, one thing I also read about your time on the Law Commission, which I'd like to explore, is the sort of media attacks that you came under, I think particularly by the Daily Mail. And was that the first time were you in the glare of publicity?
Yes. I mean, there was quite a lot of publicity when I was first appointed to the Law Commission because I was the first woman. But that was the usual sort of short burst. But there was a stage, and it had to do with our domestic violence recommendations, because we proposed that victims of domestic violence and abuse who were not married to the abuser could have protective remedies as married people could. And they wrongly thought that that meant that they were getting the same property rights married couples. They weren't at all. They just didn't understand. Maybe we hadn't explained it properly, but mainly they just hadn't taken it in. We weren't suggesting they should have the same property rights. But this was an attack on marriage. So the law commissioners became legal commissars subverting family values. But very much to the credit of the then Lord Chancellor, who had been forced by this outburst to withdraw the bill at the very end, he brought it back the following session, and it more or less got enacted in the form that we had proposed. Again, a few complications, but more or less in that form. So it was an unfortunate episode, but it didn't in the end do much harm.
Right. And were you able to deal with that publicity, that negative publicity? And how yes. How did you deal with it?
Well, you just have to say, well, that's going to happen. If you stick your head above the parapet from time to time, people will shoot at it. Politicians get much, much worse than law commissioners or judges do. Politicians have to suffer this all the time. Right. Yeah. Whereas we just tend to get it when a particular case hits the headlines.
Yeah. Okay. So now we're coming to the end of your time in the High Court, just before you come to the Court of Appeal. But I'd like to just explore one little thing which I picked up from your biography again, your autobiography again, about your time in the High Court. And you had this phrase, good liars can be good witnesses.
Oh, really? Yes.
Yes. And I'd like you just to sort of expand on that for our listeners. What did you mean by that as a High Court judge, that good liars can make good witnesses?
Well, that's one of the problems, isn't it? That somebody who has thought out a story that they wish to tell can be very well rehearsed in it, very fluent, very plausible, not have any of the hesitations, the scratching of heads, the all the things that people who are really honestly trying to do their best tend to have. And so it was just, don't be taken in by the fluidity and plausibility, because that may be rehearsed.
And would you say that you ended up as a good assessor of a liar or demeanor?
I have no idea. you would have to ask the advocates who appeared in front of me.
Right.
Generally speaking, because as a High Court judge, I was mostly doing family cases. And generally speaking, in family cases, if it's between two adults, they are recognisably describing the same incident. It's just that they have convinced themselves of a truth of that incident, which is not the exact truth of it. And the truth is usually somewhere in between. Much harder, of course, was the child abuse cases that we had a lot of, serious child abuse cases. And there you were assessing the medical evidence most of the time. And so that was an academic exercise, by which I mean an objective assessment of the validity of the findings and their interpretation. And that wasn't deciding. Well, you were deciding whether the person who was denying having done anything was telling the truth, but that was you were mostly doing that on the basis of the overwhelming evidence to the contrary.
Yeah.
Can I, as a judge, do you have any particular rules that you set up your own after a few years of judging to assess credibility? Because for Gopal and I, we are both, we are advocates, and frequently we have to take up matters to the Court of Appeal, to our final Court of Appeal, the Federal Court. And the phrase, we at the appellate courts do not interfere with the audiovisual advantage of the trial judge, and so on and so forth, all this comes ringing to us. So I'm asking you now, Lady Hale, as a former trial judge, do you have any particular way of assessing credibility of witnesses?
Well, the two most important things on the whole are, is always said, any contemporaneous record or document as close to the events as possible, and the inherent probabilities about things. Now, those are not invariably reliable, but it's a good check on what you're being told by the witnesses. How consistent is it with what was actually physically there at the time, in the way of records, or indeed other sorts of things like the topography of the place? If you're looking at a road accident, how does it fit in with what the road was like, and the weather, and the visibility, and all of those things. So those are the two things. We're always told, don't rely too much on demeanour. Because almost for the reason I was giving earlier about, good liars can be good witnesses, what looks like a confident, coherent story may not actually be the truth. So it's true that one mustn't rely too much on demeanour. But on the other hand, you can pick up an awful lot from the atmosphere in the courtroom. You can pick up, especially in family cases, you can pick up a lot about the relationships between the people involved, from body language, eye contact, lack of eye contact, not so much with you, but with the other people in the room. And the great thing about being a judge is that you can see everything that's going on.
Yeah. And I'm guessing that's particularly so with children as well, when you've got children in court. And their body language and how they look at people will certainly be very, very indicative. Okay, you went to the Court of Appeal, Lady Hale, after just 5 years in the High Court. What was the biggest difference being an appellate judge? The biggest difference between the High Court and being an appellate judge?
Well, the biggest difference for me, which is why I was keen to go to the Court of Appeal, was that I was dealing with a much wider range of legal subject matter. So I was in the civil division of the Court of Appeal, but that meant one dealt with all kinds of cases, personal injury cases, contract cases, commercial cases, property cases, everything, even intellectual property cases, as well as family. So that was the biggest difference. But then, of course, the difference is that you're not actually deciding the case. You are second-guessing what the poor bloody foot soldier decided. So one has to try and be humble, you know, retain the memory of life in the trial judge's seat in order not to be too critical of what they're doing. So those are the two biggest differences, obviously.
And what about sitting with two other judges?
Oh, that's fine. That's yes. On the whole, it's fine, you know, obviously.
Yeah. Sure.
Not always, but mostly we get on very well, I think, and try and reach a consensus, you know. But if you can't, well, then it is always your right to dissent if you want to. So that's also a good safety valve.
Lady Hill, your route to the judiciary was very much different from your colleagues at that time, I think, even now. Were you made welcome? Was there any issues that you didn't follow the usual conventional route up to become a judge?
I think if there had been any issues, it would have been when I joined the family division, you know, the High Court, when I first became a High Court judge. And I wasn't aware of any issues at all. Everybody was very friendly and welcoming. It might have been because, here we go back to following on from people, but they had Elizabeth Butler Sloss, who was our first woman Court of Appeal judge, but she was also, of course, before that, a judge in the family division. And she had been promoted to the family division from the bottom rung of the judiciary. So she had skipped the middle rung, which sometimes happens. And, you know, eyebrows were raised at that, but she was an extremely good, you know, family division judge. So I think they were more used to taking people who hadn't necessarily come through the usual route. That may be it. So, but there will have been whisperings, no doubt, but I wasn't aware of them. Of course, by the time I got to the Court of Appeal, I had sat from time to time in the Court of Appeal because we were all, if we wanted to, in the High Court, given in the family division particularly, given the opportunity of spending a few weeks sitting in the Court of Appeal. And I'd done that whenever I had the opportunity. And so I think most of the members of the Court of Appeal did know me, probably knew that I wasn't there to frighten the horses. I could be difficult on occasions, but not often. So.
From there, of course, you moved to the House of Lords and then later the Supreme Court, as it became. I'd like to ask you, in terms of the appellate process, the deliberation part of that, what did you enjoy the most and what did you dislike the most of that process?
Well, the tradition in the House of Lords and in the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council, and it has been, as far as I know, maintained in the Supreme Court, was that after the hearing, there would be a meeting between the law lords or the justices, and we would go around the table, starting with the most junior. So that was the scariest thing, when you were the most junior, being the person who had to say, well, this is what I think the outcome should be, and this is why. Not a long disquisition, but, you know, enough to explain one's thinking. And we went round the table in order of seniority, which meant that by the time it got to the presider, who was number 5 or number 7 or number 9, depending on how many were sitting, it was usually quite obvious, you know, which way the wind was blowing. Not always. Sometimes it could be 2-2 and then the presider would have to decide. But normally it was quite obvious and what the reasoning was. And so it was much easier for the presider than it was for everybody else. But you can imagine what it was like being the most junior, especially there was a time in the Supreme Court where the now deputy president, Lord Hodge, was the most junior member of the court for a very long time. But he weathered the storm with great equanimity. But there we go. So that was the most difficult thing. On the whole, we did mostly reach agreement. I think 80% of cases in the Supreme Court are unanimous judgments. And we tried to get away from the habit in the certain at certain times amongst the law lords, of where everybody was agreed on the outcome, but everybody wrote a judgment. Now, that was lovely for them, and of course, lovely for advocates with the next case, because they could spend ages picking apart the differences between the judgments in order to support their side of the argument. But from the point of view of the parties to the case, knowing why they had won or lost, from the point of view of the lower courts, knowing what they should be doing and why they should be doing it, the point of view of the general public, not the clearest and simplest way of trying to determine a question of law. So we did try not to do that, if we possibly could. But there were just some cases which were so sensitive that, you know, we all did have to have our say.
And speaking of writing judgments, did you enjoy the process? And if so, what was it that you enjoyed about it?
Oh, yes, I definitely enjoyed the process. Well, as I said earlier, it's not unlike writing an academic article, except that you have to come to a definite conclusion. You've got to, and it's got to be a valid conclusion. So, no, of course, set out, this is the question. This is the evidence. No, these are the facts, because in the highest court, we insisted that the parties, I don't know if it happens with your federal court, we insisted that the parties agreed a statement of facts and issues.
Oh, okay.
We didn't always stick to their statement of issues, but they agreed what the facts were, because, of course, the facts had been found in the lower courts, and we were stuck with the facts as found in the lower courts. So we didn't have to bother very much about that.
That's interesting.
It was irritating if the lower courts hadn't found all the facts that needed to be found in order to reach a definitive legal conclusion. So sometimes we had to send it back for the facts to be found. But by and large, we didn't have to bother about that. So this is the issue. These are the facts. These are the legal materials, you know, statutes or whatever cases. And of course, in the highest court, it's much easier, because you're not bound by previous decisions of the Court of Appeal. The problem in the Court of Appeal is that you're bound by previous decisions of the Court of Appeal, and there are loads of them, and they are not always easy to reconcile. So an awful lot of Court of Appeal judgments was going through the earlier case law and trying to make sense of it. Well, by and large, in the House of Lords Supreme Court, we were bound by previous House of Lords or Supreme Court decisions, unless we decided deliberately to depart from them, but we didn't do that very frequently. It's been done rather more frequently recently, but it hasn't. We didn't do it very often. So we had greater freedom to think about it in principle rather than trying to reconcile difficult to reconcile authorities. So writing judgments in the House of Lords and the Supreme Court was great. And the other thing is that you can add context. Because you've got the time. You've got the time to think about the context within which this particular legal point is being decided. And so I always used to try and add a bit of context into what I was saying in my judgments.
You've been described as a judge with a human touch. And I was wondering, how important do you feel that sort of empathy is to being a judge?
I think it's very important to have empathy, particularly as a trial judge. So you do have to try and understand where the witnesses are coming from, where the parties are coming from, why they see things the way that they do. This is particularly true in family cases, but it's true in all sorts of cases. You know, most disputes, there's an emotional aspect to most disputes, isn't there? Even if they're the most commercial disputes in the case, there are always emotions going on there. And so it's good to be able to try and think yourself into their shoes in order to try and get the right result. But I also think, even as an appellate judge, to try and express some empathy with a party. The example that people tend to give was when we had a case about the war in Iraq. And we were being asked indirectly to decide whether it was a lawful war or not. And That wasn't the issue that we could decide. We had a different issue to decide. But I did want to say to the mothers of the soldiers who had died in that war that, you know, if I had a son who was going to war or a child who was going to war, I would want to be reassured that that was a lawful war.
Mm.
So I understood entirely why it was that they were bringing the claim, even though we couldn't give them what they wanted. And
sure.
Little things like that. It doesn't take a lot of effort. It doesn't take much, but it adds to, I think, the feeling that people have been properly listened to and thought about.
Lady Hay, could I ask about advocacy at the Supreme Court, the House of Lords? Obviously, there, written submissions have been filed weeks earlier before counsel appears. Do you actually find counsel's submission really helpful in changing your minds or clarifying certain points? I mean, Lord Diplock famously had a position. I mean, people say that he never changes ever his mind. Right? So do you actually find the oral advocacy of counsel on the day of the hearing actually helpful or add anything new? Or actually, because you've read the submissions, you more or less knew what the position would be?
Well, different cases, different advocates, different, you know, there isn't any one thing. But I think most of us in the House of Lords and Supreme Court went into court with a reasonably open mind. So we wanted to listen to the argument because we had read, you know, you read the appellant's case and, oh, that's very convincing. And then you read the respondent's case. Oh, that's very convincing. So you need to be argued into which of them actually is correct. And the best advocates were those who could take the absolute essence of their case from what was often too long a written case and turn it into something comparatively brief, comparatively simple and straightforward, and completely convincing. The best ones do that.
Yes. I remember the words, one judgment you wrote, bristling with simplicity. I think that's something you enjoyed.
Well, that's right. I took that. That was the advocate who said, you know, this case bristles with simplicity. And he was absolutely right. It did. But it was a commercial case. And my experience of commercial cases is that, on the whole, the lawyers try and make things as complicated as possible. Whether they think that's going to pull the wool over the judge's eyes or whatever, but that is a tendency. Maybe it's because they think that their clients are going to admire them for that. So getting back down to what the essence of the case is always the most helpful thing.
Next question I was going to ask, and I wonder whether you want to expand on it anymore, just what you've just said, which is, how do the best barristers take you from the opening submission to judgment?
Oh, well, I suppose if they give you a route, you know, which I think you'll probably find that quite a few judgments are heavily dependent on the argument that one party or the other. I think this is particularly true in the Court of Appeal, where time is short and so on. Less so because we have plenty of time in the Supreme Court and we could definitely roll our own without relying too much on what counsel had said. But to give you an intellectually satisfying route, which fitted in with the facts, fitted in with the legal materials, fitted in with legal principle, that's the best.
Okay. Last question I have on this area is about the oral submissions. As Razlan has said just now, so much is in writing now. Everything's in writing. As a bench, what do you expect from that oral submission that is not in the written work?
Well, as I said earlier, I think what you want is a distillation that gets to the heart of the case. I mean, obviously, the hearings that we have in the Supreme Court, they're much shorter than they used to be, but they are not of United States or even Canadian brevity. And so often the advocate has to take us to the authorities. So it's having a clear, logical thread of argument supported by the authorities, which we may not all have read. we may be waiting to be introduced to these authorities. We've usually read, if there's a principal one that actually governs the case, we've usually read that. But otherwise, we may be waiting to be taken through them. So it's a combination of the beguiling simplicity. Beguiling is a lovely word that somebody used about an advocate, a very famous advocate in this country. So it's the combination of that and the effective deployment of the authorities as well.
Okay. Of course, your written work, there's so many judgments from the High Court all the way through to the Supreme Court and so many important cases. But is there one that stands out for you in terms of you enjoying the deliberation and the writing process?
Well, I mean, there are some that you don't enjoy because some are comparatively boring, but mostly, I always say there are no boring cases. Occasionally there's boring advocacy, but there are no boring cases when you get to the Supreme Court. It's hard to pick out what I think I have to pick out the prorogation case. Mm. Not a case that we enjoyed having to have, because nobody wants to be in the position of telling the Prime Minister that he's done something unlawful. But of course, it was a case that we could not have, because we had one decision from England saying this is not justiciable, we're not going to touch it. And we had another case from Scotland saying not only is it justiciable, but it's unlawful. They couldn't both be right. Either Parliament had or Parliament had not been prorogued. And so we had to take the case, and we had to do it very quickly. We had to hear it quickly, and we had to write the judgment quickly. And so I'm very proud of the court and my colleagues and the parties, you know, for everybody being prepared to do it at breakneck speed. Not necessarily at any sacrifice of quality, may I say. You know, I think the submissions were just as good. And I think the judgment was probably just as good, despite having been done at speed. So that's why I have to pick that one out.
Right.
Because in the end, it wasn't even close. It was a unanimous decision. So could I just ask about that process in which the deliberation process in which you just said just now, Lady Hill, in which the most junior starts off first and all that. So was that it wasn't a particularly difficult decision to come up to eventually, right?
No. One of the reasons that we could manage that was that it was a 3-day hearing, but we had heard the principal parties in the first 2 days. So I picked up what my predecessor had done in an earlier high-profile constitutional case, and I asked everybody to circulate at 9 o'clock the following morning, so not tit-for-tatting, you know, all at the same time, their answers to, is it justiciable? If it's justiciable, what are the principles? How do those principles apply to the facts of this case, and what's the outcome? So 4 things. So I got all of them to write on 1 or 2 sides of A4 their answers to those questions. And it became crystal clear that everybody thought it was justiciable. And the matter for debate was the exact fine-tuning of the principles. And what we had not heard a lot of argument about until then was what the outcome should be. Because, you know, the parties have been concentrating on the first 3 of these issues. They hadn't spent a lot of time on the outcome. Other than the government saying, well, Scotland can't be right, that it was null and void. That they'd said that. But so when we got into court the time for the replies, we actually said to the parties, we'd like to hear more about what the outcome should be.
Right.
Which was a pretty clear hint about the way our minds were working.
Yeah. That's an interesting process. That really is.
Well, it worked very well on that occasion. And obviously there was a certain amount of to-ing and fro-ing in the course of the final day between members of the court, but working on the fine-tuning of the principles. And so by the time we got to the actual meeting, we were mostly clear about what the principles were. It was a question of the outcome.
Interesting.
So I presume there was no moaning on the part of your colleagues that when you tell them, look, I need an answer to this 9 a.m. tomorrow morning, right?
Yeah, it's okay. Yeah. But they all knew we got to work quickly. They knew that. And particularly if we were going to find that it was unlawful, well, then there was no point in doing so almost as the unlawful prorogation ran out. You know, we had to do it quickly enough. So everybody was up for being as quick as we possibly could. And we had had a previous experience of the earlier case where we'd done something very similar, although the judgment took rather a lot longer to prepare.
Okay, one last area before we hit our rapid fire, which takes just about 3 or 4 minutes.
Okay, because we are running out of time.
Yes, and it is this. You've written that Jonathan Sumption's ties attracted more attention during the prorogation case than your brooches. So we just want you to tell our listeners today, describe the brooch you're wearing.
No. Can I just correct what you've just said?
Oh, please do, yes.
Yes, because by the time we did the prorogation case, Jonathan Sumption was no longer a member of the court.
Ah, yes, okay.
So it was in the earlier case, the case about the Article 50, pulling the trigger to exit the European Union. And I had very carefully chosen a different dress for each of the 4 days of the hearing. But we found that all the commentary was about Jonathan Sumption's ties rather than my dresses. So I was rather pleased about that. I thought that's good. Yes, yeah. Today I am wearing a dragonfly. I have quite a few dragonflies because they're very beautiful and they're much less controversial than spiders.
Okay, very quickly, and I know you're rushing. We can just do the rapid fire. What did you enjoy most in practice and the bench, the intellectual exercise or the interpersonal skills? Just a one-word answer if you can.
Both.
Two, the advocate that you respected the most while you were on the bench and at the bar?
At the bar, I would say Rose Heilbronn. On the bench, I would say Dinah Rose.
The judge that you respected the most when you were at the bar?
When I was at the bar? Oh, goodness me, that's impossible to answer.
Nope,
because.
Impossible. Okay.
But the judge I respected the most in the course of my career would undoubtedly be Lord Bingham. You know, who was senior law lord and would have been the first president of the Supreme Court had he not reached the retirement age before. Yes, but he's the greatest judge of this century, as far as I'm concerned.
And what is the single most important quality in a judge?
Patience.
Favorite fictional legal book?
Ooh, that's interesting. There is a book which is part fact, part fiction, called Unnatural Killings, very recently by Wendy Joseph, who has just retired or recently retired as an Old Bailey judge. And she has constructed six paradigms of unlawful killings from a variety of the cases that she saw. And she tells the story that led up to the case. She tells the story of the trial, and then she has some reflections on it. That's an excellent book.
Really? Okay. I'll look that up. And finally, a day in the life of Baroness Hale, typical day in the Supreme Court, and your typical day now.
Okay, well, I arrive in the Supreme Court. I greet a few people. I say, do my emails. I think about what's the day has in store, and a little bit of a thought about the case. Then we have a pre-meeting, if it's the first day of a case, just to work out what we think the issues are and how we would like counsel to approach them. Then you go into court and you sit quietly. No, you don't sit quietly. Obviously, you ask questions, but you do also try and listen carefully. And you do that from 10:30 to 1 o'clock. And then you get up and you... I always used to go and have lunch. We have a dining room in the Supreme Court, and it's a simple lunch, you know, soup and salad and so on. But I used to go and have lunch and then go and do some more thinking or some more communicating, you know, emails and letters and so on. Then back into court at 2 o'clock. until 4. And then, of course, if it was a one-day case, we would have the deliberations and deciding what the outcome is. And if you're presiding, you have to decide who's going to write the lead judgment, the document judgment, as I call it. And then there will be more of the reading for the next case or reading for applications for permission to appeal, etc., etc. And so then one makes one's way home or to whatever goes on in the evening, and there are often events in the evening, often of a legal nature, you know, conferences or things to do with the Inns of Court. So that's a typical day as a judge. Well, now take out the sitting in court. It's quite similar, really, except that it's at home. You know, I'm doing a lot of communicating. I'm doing quite a lot of writing. I'm doing, which involves doing quite a lot of reading. I'm doing things like this. So, yes, it's a very busy time, but the things that I'm busy on are slightly different because I'm not deciding cases anymore.
Well, I'm glad to hear it is a busy time.
It is.
Baroness Hale, thank you very much for being on our podcast.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It's been thoroughly enjoyable, and it's lovely that we're able to communicate.
Yes,
like this,
it is.
As if you're in the next room, when in fact you are many thousands of miles away. It's a wonderful feeling. And of course, we have so much in common, which is another wonderful feeling.
Yes,
so,
yes.
Thank you both very much, indeed.
Thank you for listening to Advocates, the podcast. I hope you've enjoyed the program. Please follow us on all our social media channels. Leave a review or share this episode. And don't forget to tag us. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks.
Listen to the voices of the advocate.